Well, thank you for coming today. We're going to go ahead and get started. If you want to pick up some of the high-quality comestibles at the other end of the room, that's fine. Please just do so quietly so that you don't disturb everyone at this end too much. What we're going to do today is continue with the study historically of the persons throughout history who have desired to restore the New Testament church. We talked a little bit last time about some of the fellowships from the early Middle Ages, the high Middle Ages, some of the many persons in the Middle Ages who thought that there were better ways of seeking God than the large established churches. What we're going to look at today is continuing with the historical survey. We want to talk about the Protestant Reformation next week, even though that's not something that we tend to directly relate to. There still are a lot of things that were involved in that are important themes from our point of view, that are valuable insights that they can offer us for our own ministries. And so this week, what we're going to take a look at is some of the roots of what's called the so-called Protestant Reformation, some of the forerunners, because it's if you read conventional history, sometimes they will just tell you that all of a sudden in the 1500s, Martin Luther came along and threw things into confusion. And in reality, it was kind of the result of a long process with a lot of different roots in a lot of different places. We're going to talk about, as kind of a theme, since we are well beyond the biblical era now, we want to kind of take a look at some scriptures every week to get some perspective. So we're going to look at John 4 and 1 Corinthians 3 first before we get into our historical survey. And then we're going to talk about some of the many persons who talked about trying to get back to New Testament Christianity in the Middle Ages. Ben had a great day yesterday. The Buckeyes won, the Reds won, so Ben is feeling especially spiritual and thankful today, and so he is going to lead us in a time of prayer.
Bow with me, please. Father, Lord God, we're just so thankful to be here today, just so thankful to have a God like you that just loves us so much that he's willing to give us all that you have given us, Father. Father, we pray today that you can just open our hearts and open our minds to your word. And so, Father, we ask that you touch us, and that your word touches us, and that we take your word and we use it in our lives, Father, and that we meditate on it, and that we dwell on it, and that we can't help but speak about it the rest of our lives throughout our time here on this earth. Father, we pray today that you speak through Mark, and again, that we can hear your word and dwell on them, Father. Father, again, we just thank you so much for being such a loving God and giving us the ultimate gift, which is Jesus. We can't thank you enough for him. And it's in his name we pray. Amen.
All right. Thanks very much. Let's look at some scriptures before we get into our historical survey for the week. First of all, over in John chapter 4, picking up here in verse 36, this is towards the end of the account of the meeting between Jesus and the Samaritan woman at Jacob's well. Doc, could you read that for us, 36 through 38? And then, Lloyd, could you take this next one for us, 1 Corinthians 3, verses 6 to 9?
So that the sower and the reaper may be glad together. Thus the saying, one sows and another reaps, is true. I sent you to reap what you have not worked for. Others have done the hard work, and you have reaped the benefits of their labor.
1 Corinthians 3, 6. I planted the seed, Apollos watered it, but God made it grow. So neither he who plants nor he who waters is anything, but only God who makes things grow. The man who plants and the man who waters have one purpose, and each will be rewarded according to his own labor. For we are God's fellow workers. You are God's field, God's building.
Okay, very good. These are two scriptures that kind of have a common theme. In both cases, they're reminding us that none of us can do it all by ourselves. None of us has had to make every sacrifice and learn every teaching about God all on our own from scratch. We've all shared in to some degree in ministering to God and in learning about God, and we all do this both in a contemporary way, the body of Christ being made up of many parts, and also in a historical way. So these ideas have relevance both from a ministry point of view and from a historical point of view and from other perspectives as well. John 4, Jesus is talking to the disciples and they have come back, see him in this lengthy conversation with this woman, and if you remember the context, their first reaction on coming back is to say, "I think you need to eat something, Rabbi." And he says, "My food is to finish the work of him who sent me and to do his will." And then he goes into this little talk in which we jumped into the middle, where he says, he talks about the reaper draws his wages and he harvests the crop for eternal life. So he kind of uses their preoccupation with food. Interesting how this parallels transcend history there, isn't it? Their preoccupation with food is used as a spiritual example with him. And he talks about how the fields are ripe for harvest. But one thing that he adds that sometimes we forget with these analogies is he talks about you guys didn't have to do the hard work. Who did the hard work in this analogy that he's making here? What does he mean by that? Who's done the harder work that the disciples just came along for the harvest?
Other Christians preached to him, and he's entered into their labors.
He's talking about others who've gone before them, right?
No.
I think maybe he's talking about like the Old Testament prophets and so forth.
Sure, all the prophets, all the people in the Old Testament who had to minister and serve in so many different ways and sacrifice in so many different ways, as Hebrews tells us, they did so without ever getting to see the fulfillment of all those promises.
Some people a little more recent, but before them, like John Baptist.
That's another good example, because even to prepare the way for Jesus, they didn't have to do that. John the Baptist was the one that had to kind of kickstart everything. He came around when nobody was even thinking about Jesus and had to arouse the attention. And what he's talking about then is, he says, one sows and another reaps. I've sent you to reap where you have not worked. Others have done the hard work and you've reaped the benefits of their labor. It's a common theme in so many areas of life that we all like to get the full credit for what we've done, but we don't want to see how much other people had to do to get that to happen. And it's certainly true in our ministries. We always get preoccupied with certain types of ministry that are more visible or most praised, and sometimes we forget that it's all interrelated. The body is made up of many different parts, some doing things that are seen, some doing things that are not seen. He says, others have done the hard work, and in this case, you know, all those prophets and priests in the Old Testament and the leaders like Moses and that, they might not have had to work physically harder than the disciples did, but they had to work without getting to see the end result. They just had to take these promises and know that what they were doing was preserving these promises for future generations. The disciples are going to get to be around when they see it all come together and when they get to see everything that God had planned for all these years. Now, over in 1 Corinthians, the other passage that we read, this is a different situation. In Corinth, one of the things that's going on is the Corinthians are going around competing with each other. They're talking about, I'm a follower of Paul. I'm a follower of Apollos. I like the way Apollos does things. And they're all debating with each other, competing with each other. And then you learn later in the book of Corinthians, when they come together for a quote-unquote worship, what are they doing? Hey, I'm the speaker in tongues. Let me have the floor here. Oh, no, I'm prophesying. Let me have the floor over here. And they're talking against each other, and it's a chaotic situation because they all think they've got the spiritual gift that's the coolest, that's the greatest sign of God's approval. And this competition is kind of a part of the fleshly nature. And so this is what Paul addresses here in chapter 3. He mentions, for example, himself and Apollos, and he's rather disturbed because there are people who are using him to compete with other people. There are people who are using Paul himself. Oh, yeah, I'm a follower of Paul. Yeah, Paul is the coolest. And he wants to say, no, that's not true at all. I did one thing. Apollos did another thing. These other guys did something else. It's all valuable, but neither he who plants nor he who waters is anything. Because what's the one indispensable feature? Is God. God makes it grow. Without God, Apollos is nothing and I'm nothing. And so it's an even more important point that he makes here is that even if we analyze things in terms of our ministries and who's doing what and who's depending on that? Or historically, will we depend on things that other people did before us and they depend on things that people did before them and so on? Eventually, where does it all get traced back to? Eventually, it all comes back to God and to God's graciousness and to God's compassion for us. You can analyze things in terms of our talents and abilities, but where did they come from? They came from God. You can say, this guy's got a really good talent and, you know, he's really great and we should listen to him. Well, that talent came from God. Before that guy was born, he didn't have the foresight to ask God for this valuable talent. It just got lucky. It was just given him. And these people in history that did all these things, we owe a debt to them, but they owe a debt to people who came before them, but even more importantly, they owe it to God. And what it's saying is it's a powerful reminder to be humbled. And we started last week looking at all the way back in the Middle Ages, how many different fellowships there were. You know, we talked about the Paulicians and the Bogomils and the Cathars and the Waldenses and all these people who long, long ago had the same basic desire that we do. Hey, let's get back to the scriptures, the gospel, the New Testament for our model for what we're doing. Well, they all had that idea a long time before we did. And we're going to look at some other people today who had that idea a long time before we did. And whether or not we want to admit it, every person and every church and every institution in human society, whatever it is always to a very large degree a product of its own time and place. There's no such thing as an institution, whether it's the Catholic Church or the Churches of Christ or the Baptist Church or the U.S. government or the Russian government or the French government or anything else. There's no such thing as an institution that brilliant people just separated themselves from the rest of the world and came up with something all in a vacuum. There's no such thing. Human beings are not like that. And it's important that we understand how interrelated everything is. Each of us, of course, is our own little universe. We all have our own concerns, our own desires, which ultimately we all have to stand before God and answer to God and be accepted by God in fellowship forever or be told to leave one way or another in some sense. And so it's natural that we all want to look at things from our own point of view. But there is a value of an individual and limitations on an individual. The only thing that's really indispensable, the only true, lasting, infinite value that a human being has is his or her soul. Because that's the only thing that's irreplaceable. If you choose to separate yourself from God and not to seek God, then even if all the other 5 or 6 billion people in the world choose to seek God, that's still an irreparable loss. Your soul, your capacity to know God is of infinite value. And that's true of everybody that's ever lived, whether they're famous or unknown, whether they're good or evil by human standards. That's the infinite value of an individual. As workers, as ministers, as learners, we all have much more strict limitations. There's almost nothing that you can really do by yourself, no matter how much pride we want to take in what we do by ourselves. If you've ever listened to the sermons of Martin Luther King, one of his famous ones was where he got up and he kind of parodied in a very gentle way the American spirit of self-sufficiency and how we all like to think that we've done so much for ourselves. And then he starts to ask yourself, okay, this car that you think you worked so hard to earn, did you build it yourself? Could you build it yourself if you wanted to? Now, Tom's visiting. Tom could build cars himself if he wants to. But Tom, however, could not create the metal and the rubber needed for them. He can assemble all the parts for you if you put them together, but that's the limitation that he has. And then if you've heard this sermon, he goes even further. Okay, the cup of coffee that you drank to get here, you might have made it yourself, but did you grow the coffee yourself? You're dependent on a guy down in South America growing those coffee beans for you so that you could wake up in the morning and sit through these boring Bible classes by these animal freak anarchists that they let teach at your church. He would talk about how all these things that you do that you take for granted, you brush your teeth, you wash your hands, someone made those products. And the materials for those products were made in some cases halfway around the world. We're so interrelated. And it's an inherent, intrinsic fact about humanity. We like to think that we've come up with the brilliant insights. We like to think our generation, our time and place is so special. But no generation, no time and place has ever been separate from all the others. And it's not a case of that we have to feel guilty for things, or that we have to make up for things, or that we have to do things to earn it, or that we have to learn all this stuff and get it all clear in our heads and get it right now. It's a simple call to an 8-letter word that starts with an H and ends with a Y.
Humility.
Humility. Very good. Some of you still have some energy left after the Buckeye game last night. I know that was emotionally draining, but some of you can still have that.
It's energized.
Good. The whole thing from these verses, and when we get into our historical survey, it's a call to humility. There's such a tendency for us to look and pick and judge and look at people in the past or in the present and point out, well, they're doing this right, they're not doing that right. They got this right, they didn't get that right. That shows that we missed the whole point entirely. Because the basic desire to seek God for his own sake, to pull away from all the encumbrances that humans have created on Christianity and other religions, that's really the basic thing. Whether they get everything right or get everything wrong is secondary to the basic desire to know God, to get back to the gospel, to make the grace of the gospel, the truth of the gospel, the hope of the gospel the key thing. 1 Corinthians 12, of course, is a very good parallel. The body is a unit, and though it's made up of many parts, the parts form one unit. Not everybody in the body is an eye, not everybody in the body is an ear, not everybody is a foot. Some of the parts of the body seem to have very trivial purposes, and yet in reality, what does Paul say about them? They're indispensable. You may not even see it. You ever seen your liver? You want to try living without it for a few minutes? Well, there's people in the church that are the same way. Sure, you don't see them. Sure, you denigrate them because all they apparently do is show up every Sunday, but their ministry to God is indispensable. You may not ever know why. It's not important. Just realize that every part of the body is crucial. Historically, all the things that went before us have left us a legacy for good or for ill, and we've been influenced by it whether you realize it or not. What we call the churches of Christ in 21st century America, they've been heavily influenced by a lot of other things that happened long before us, whether we want to admit that or not. It's not a problem, not anything we need to apologize for. Again, what's the answer that God's looking for? Just a little more humility, a little less certainty that we've got it all right and we're the ones that have figured it out. Okay, last week we talked about some of the persons in the early and high Middle Ages who had these, what we would call, restoration fellowships, attempts to come back to New Testament Christianity. We're kind of looking ahead because we want to learn some lessons from the Protestant Reformation, which we'll get to next week. We're not going to talk about that this time. What we're going to look at is kind of continuing last week is some lesser known efforts, teachings, people who, again, looked at the situation in the Middle Ages with these large, monolithic, established churches and said, we can do better. And there's a couple of reasons for looking at these, because once again, we find that we have a lot of brothers and sisters in the past who try to do things very similar to what we, at least nominally, are trying to do, and yet the conditions were a lot different. Maybe they had less success. Maybe their groups didn't survive. And yet, that doesn't mean that we should ignore them or fail to appreciate them. And in this case, we're getting a little closer towards modern times. The churches of Christ wouldn't exist if it hadn't been for some of the denominations that existed a couple hundred years ago that created a situation that led persons to the insights that created our fellowship. Those groups can be traced back in turn to other Protestant denominations that occurred back in the Reformation. The Reformation in turn can be traced back to these guys. I'm sure we like to say to ourselves, oh, we've got nothing to do with those filthy denominations, but yeah, we do. We've got a great deal to do with them. And a lot of the things that we teach, a lot of things we believe, can be traced back to them. Some of the good things and some of the mistakes too. So it's well worth knowing about this and understanding that in many ways we've reaped the benefits of others' hard work. We have sown where we have not reaped. And neither he who planted nor he who watered was ever anything anyway. It all had to do with God who makes things grow. Well, in the late Middle Ages, one of the persons well worth knowing about is this guy called John Wycliffe. He's from England. He was a professor at Oxford University. And he was kind of at his peak of his career at the time when the Catholic Church had split and they had the popes had moved to Avignon in France. We talked about that last week. There was these rival popes. There was the group of cardinals that elected a pope that was in Avignon, France, and then there was a group of cardinals that elected a pope in Rome. And it was split up, and so a lot of people were starting to see there's been some problems here that we didn't notice with this whole concept of the pope being in charge of everything and the cardinals being in charge of everything. And Wycliffe was able to kind of put this in a way that the average person could relate to. He kind of showed how the flaw is not, the Catholic Church is what it is. It wasn't a special group of people making special mistakes. The flaw goes back a little deeper. The flaw goes back to looking towards human authority. The flaw goes back to letting human beings make all the decisions instead of all of us in our hearts seeking God, trying to know God. And Wycliffe, in particular, like many other people had, realized that what we really need to do is we need to look at the gospel, we need to look at the scriptures, we need to get our teachings from that, not from the pope, not from the cardinals. It's our own fault if we've let them tell us what to do. It's not their fault, they are what they are. If we let them tell us what to do, it's our own fault if things become a mess. Wycliffe is kind of popularly called, he has this nickname, the Morning Star of the Reformation. Because Wycliffe kind of had a direct legacy to some of the people that came later in the Protestant Reformation. And of course, that's not really our primary interest, but there's still a lot to learn from that. Wycliffe kind of taught this famous series of lessons at Oxford. He called it On Civil Lordship. And it was kind of his first great insight into the problems of the church of his day, is that the whole problem comes from letting the church become an institution, letting it become an organization in its own right, with leaders that have their own self-interest, with meddling in political affairs, with acquiring secular power, with acquiring wealth. And he gave this very popular series of lectures at Oxford, popular with the English people, I should say, not very popular with church authorities. Fortunately for Wycliffe, he had a few important friends amongst the English nobility, and they were able to stop the church officials from arresting him and torturing him and doing all the things that they so much enjoyed doing to heretics. But Wycliffe did not stop at just teaching, because he knew that if he just made himself the new oracle and the new proclaimer of truth, it would lead in the same place eventually. Wycliffe undertook, like we talked about Peter Waldo last week, when Peter Waldo was active in France and in Italy trying to get people to return to the Bible, one of the things he did was he worked at translating the Bible into their own languages. Well, Wycliffe translated the Bible from the Latin version that was then the only church-authorized version, translated it into English. Spent a lot of time on it. It took him several years, but he was able to translate it into the English language. Now, this was just before the invention of the printing press, which we'll actually talk about a little bit later today. So it was a very difficult thing to write up these Bibles. Wycliffe liked to call his people the poor preachers, but nobody ever called them that. They called them the Lollards. Lollards comes from an old word which means mumblers, because what Wycliffe taught people to do, he said, if you think that we're on to something important here, his whole concept of ministry and evangelism was very simple. He was translating his Bible, and Bibles at the time had to be hand copied page by page, word by word, and so rather than expect everyone to hang around and wait to get a whole Bible, he would just give people a page or two of the Bible. He would pass them out to people and say, just take this and you go and talk to people about it. Just read it and comment on it. Don't worry about the results. Don't worry about the doctrines. Just get people thinking and talking about the Bible instead of talking about church rituals and stuff like that. And so his followers would just literally take one page out of the Bible and they would go around, and if people were in the marketplace, they'd just read it and say, what do you think about that? Or they would read it and say, huh, that kind of helps me to see that God cares about us. Or, interesting, God's interested in our lives, isn't he? And they would just let it go from there. They were completely untrained. He didn't bother teaching them rhetoric or how to make soaring proclamations or anything like that, or how to argue with people. He just said, get people talking about the Bible. And so they were called the mumblers, the Lollards, because that's all they did. Unimpressive. Well, we would probably be just as unimpressed, wouldn't we, too? Because we tend to rely on who can convict people, who can motivate people, who can get people out there doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing. Instead, it's people who just know how to get you to think about God. We kind of denigrate that too. But it was an important seed. And Wycliffe, these simple actions aroused a lot of opposition, because the church officials in the medieval Catholic Church, they could tell right away where this was going to lead if it was not stopped. They understood that there was a reason why they'd so carefully kept people from reading the Bible all these years. In fact, for most of the Middle Ages, the Roman authorities simply discouraged you from reading the Bible by making the only version you could read, the Latin Vulgate, which was almost 1,000 years old, and which was very hard for non-scholars to read. In 1229, they actually made it illegal for you to read the Bible unless you were part of the Catholic clergy. Since 1229, which is long before Wycliffe, about 150 years before we're talking about, you could actually get thrown in jail for reading the Bible if you were not a priest or a cardinal or something like that. Well, the support that Wycliffe had at home was enough to keep him active till the end of his life. He died peacefully. The Catholic Church did take its revenge about 40 years later when the political situation in England had changed. They had his dead body exhumed and they put it on trial, sentenced him to death as a heretic, and they burned it at the stake. So kind of unsatisfying, but eventually they got back at him. This other guy, Jan Hus, you're less likely to know of him today. In his time, he was called the Continental Wycliffe, but he was also an important forerunner of Martin Luther because he lived in Bohemia, which today is the western half of the Czech Republic, for those of you who have the map of Europe clear in your head. The nation of Bohemia, or the region of Bohemia, at the time was subject to what we've talked about, the so-called Holy Roman Empire. And Hus had some of the same ideas Wycliffe did. He'd read Wycliffe's writings and been inspired by them, but he also kind of got it tangled up with this agenda of making Bohemia an independent country. He was kind of a nationalist, and so he was a lot more aggressive. He would, in his mind, the ills of the Catholic Church were tied together with the political oppression that Bohemia was struggling with, and so he kind of tended to alienate everybody. He alienated the church leaders and he alienated the political leaders at the same time. But he did leave behind a lot of good teachings, because Hus did see very clearly some of the same things Wycliffe did. The problem is that he got it tangled up with this political agenda, which we often tend to do today. Well, Hus aroused the ire of the Catholic Church, and going back to the story of the multiple papacy, you might remember that they finally resolved it at the Council of Constance starting in 1415. Well, the early part of that council, they had these three different popes arguing with each other. You know, they'd had rival groups of cardinals, another rival group had now come up with a third pope. And so the first part of this council was very chaotic and unsatisfying. And Emperor Sigismund was presiding at the council, and so he got a little impatient. He decided, okay, this is going nowhere. We're going to solve one problem while we're here. So he sent for Hus in Bohemia. He said, hey, look, you've got some interesting ideas here. Why don't you come to the council and explain them to us? And by the way, I'll give you a written guarantee of your safe conduct to and from the council, so you don't have to worry about us persecuting you or anything just because some people are saying you're a heretic. So who said, that sounds cool. The council's interested in hearing my ideas. So he shows up at the council. The emperor says, this man is a heretic. Promises made to him are therefore invalid. And they arrested him, tortured him, and executed him. So kind of brought an abrupt end to his legacy. Sometime after his death, though, some of his followers were able to separate his political agenda from this concept of returning to the New Testament. And so there was a fellowship that was known to Martin Luther that was started based on more of a simple return to New Testament Christianity, the Unitas Fratrum, the unity of the brothers, the unity of the brethren. And this was around, not in a very effective form, and unfortunately it suffered from a lot of leadership conflicts, another one of those timeless things, but it was still around long enough for Martin Luther to read about it, and he kind of put it together with what Wycliffe was doing and got a lot of ideas that he was able to use. And so even though the emperor struck back at Jan Hus, his ideas lived on. And the ideas brought up by these guys, again, if you analyze them and what they did and try to compare them to our beliefs and our doctrines and so forth, you're going to be unsatisfied. But the point again is just how universal and timeless this desire is. Let's get away from all this ritual, the tradition, the humans bossing us around and telling us what to do. Let's see if we can figure out what it says in the gospel. Let's just see if we can see that for ourselves. People have done that in many different times and places. Next little historical unit has to do with internal calls for reform, because all through the years of the Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church tend to get the image of them, if you read the conventional histories, that everybody was just a happy camper and everyone just went along with it all those years. Well, there were a lot of people who were very faithful to the Catholic Church all their lives and yet still saw its deficiencies for what it was. And it's one of the things, again, that sometimes we miss. You can be a very faithful member of the Churches of Christ and love them for what they are. I'm very happy that I found them. I grew up in an irreligious environment, and then when I came to believe in God, I had to hunt around with all these ridiculous denominations cluttering up the landscape and find one that wasn't completely bizarre and ridiculous. Well, yeah, I love the Churches of Christ, but you know what? I still see that they have a lot of problems. There's nothing wrong with loving a fellowship and still seeing its problems for what it was. And it's a mistake to think that the medieval Catholic Church was just a bunch of papists who enjoyed bossing people around, because there were a lot of lovely people in the medieval Catholic Church. There are a lot of spiritual people, a lot of people who saw the ills of the church for what it was, but it was the only game in town. Now, they did see some of these other people going off and starting their own groups. Their own perspective was, well, maybe that's the best thing to do, but I think I can do more good by sticking right here and trying to fix the problems. And you know, there's nothing wrong with that perspective. There's a lot to be said for it. Who knows in the long run what you're going to accomplish? They didn't have the benefit of history like we do. A number of people that you may or may not have heard of, and if you didn't hear of them, you're going to hear of them unless you're still busy with your comestibles, which is fine. They're worth knowing about. There's a guy called William of Ockham who you actually may have heard about if you've taken science classes and not realize it. He lived in the 14th century in England. He was a Franciscan friar. The Franciscans we talked about a couple weeks ago, they go back to Francis of Assisi, who believed in a simple life, getting in touch with nature, freeing yourself of material things as the best way to know God. That's the Franciscan order. Ockham was a Franciscan leader, and he initiated a discussion about the concept of apostolic poverty. And this is something that is very important to the Franciscans. The Franciscans believed in giving up your worldly possessions and devoting your life to God. It's something that, being intelligent people, the Franciscans had kept to themselves before Ockham. They realized that this would not go over too well with the church authorities because they didn't believe in apostolic poverty or in poverty of any kind. They believed in apostolic wealth. Well, Ockham was a very brilliant scholar, very brilliant teacher, and he very carefully and very gently challenged a lot of the things about the medieval church at the time, the wealth that they'd accumulated, the political power that they had. And he got in a lot of trouble, but he had a lot of people in high places to support him, and so he was able to keep from being punished, although it cost him a lot of good opportunities having this differing point of view. Ockham used as his example Jesus and the apostles. He didn't go into all the history of the tradition. He just encouraged people, read the Bible for yourself, read the New Testament, and you tell me what kind of a lifestyle Jesus had. Read the New Testament and you tell me what kind of a lifestyle Paul had. Read the New Testament, you tell me what kind of a lifestyle Peter's had. And then, Pope, since you claim to be Peter's spiritual heir, tell me whether you're living the same kind of lifestyle. Very simple, to us very obvious, but very bold, very courageous. And I will point out that to Ockham had this, would have said exactly what we do. I think Christianity needs to be based on the Bible. To him, that's what jumped out. To us, other things jump out. But to him, that jumped out because, you know, if he would come in here, he would probably say a lot of the same things to us. He would probably say a lot of things to us in terms of, I want you to take a look at the lifestyle Jesus and the apostle lived and tell me, is that your lifestyle? Because we would have the same answer that the popes did, if we were honest. Not to the same degree, because most of us are not deliberately accumulating a lot of ill-gotten gains like the Pope, and we're not bossing around, but there's a lot of things that certainly I wouldn't want to make do without, that I can look and say, you know, the apostles, they managed to live without it, and they managed to do some things without it. Tom, did you want to add a comment on that?
Just saying we have a current historian, Richard Hughes, who of Churches of Christ, written, co-author of Discovering Our Roots, also is now associated in teaching at Messiah College. He is saying we've overlooked that very much in our tradition,
And that's basically the point is, one of the things you see when you look at all these brothers and sisters from the past, they all have this same idea. Hey, we need to get back to the Bible. We need to get back to the gospel. But it means different things to different people. We see certain things. Yeah, getting back to the gospel means we need to be baptized by immersion for forgiveness of sins instead of these silly human rites. You know what? We're right. But then the other thing is we turn around and we don't see some of the glaring things that just jump out at other people like Occam. Now, just to mention, if you've ever taken a science class, you may have seen something called Occam's razor. For whatever reason, scientists like to misspell his name, and so they spell it O-C-C-A-M instead of the way that it's actually spelled. It's a principle in science that if you have two possible explanations that are equally likely, you should always choose the simpler one. Occam himself actually put it a little bit differently. He said, entities should not be multiplied beyond necessity. Okay. In this case, the scientists actually came up with a better way of saying it. Occam is very important in philosophy, and a lot of it goes back to, again, his debates with church officials, because in his time, the Thomas Aquinas school, the scholastics, dominated Catholic theology, and they believed that every doctrine, every teaching, every fact could be proven logically. Thomas Aquinas could give you a logical proof why the Pope should have this authority. He could give you a logical proof of each miracle in the Bible. Thomas Aquinas essentially believed that if you have enough faith, you don't need faith, because there's a logical argument for everything by pure reason. Occam taught, actually, no. The scriptures teach us that there's an inherent element of faith because we're mortal beings trying to seek an eternal God. We should never expect a logical proof to everything. It's an inherent misconception. And that in philosophy, for those of you who enjoy such things, Occam's approach is known as nominalism. Aquinas' approach is known as moderate realism. I'm sure you enjoyed hearing about that. There's another group of teachers within the church called the Christian humanists. One of the things that the late Middle Ages is known for is the so-called Renaissance, the cultural awakening. The humanist school was a group of teachers and influential leaders in the Renaissance period who became so excited about the cultural achievements of the age and the technological achievements of the age that they began to believe that humanity can accomplish anything. We can just do infinite amounts of good just because we're so good and smart and we're going to learn everything and we're going to fix all the problems of the world. Well, the secular humanists, what they wanted to do is kind of reinvent every area of human knowledge. They would go back and rekindle interest in some of the writers of the past and some learning of the past and combine it with the present era and try to solve all the world's problems. The Christian humanists was a group within the Catholic Church of people who kind of took that idea and channeled it in a much more spiritual way. They kind of took that idea and instead of looking at the world out there and thinking, yeah, we can fix all the problems, they kind of took that idea and said, you know, all these problems in the church, all this ridiculous stuff with that the popes are doing and this materialism that we're getting into, we can do better than this. And the Christian humanists, instead of going back and seeking wisdom from the ancient secular writers, the ancient pagan writers, they said, maybe we ought to go back and take a good close look at the Bible, because it was very neglected in the medieval church. And they also went back and looked at some of the early Christian writings, some of the ones we talked about over the summer, the people in the early church in the first few centuries who left a lot of their writings behind so that we know what the church was like in their era. And so the Christian humanists was a very important group within the Catholic Church in the late 1400s and early 1500s. And there's a particular guy, Erasmus, Desiderius Erasmus, or often called Erasmus of Rotterdam. He was a loyal Catholic. He loved the church, but he was convinced of its defects. And Erasmus was one of these humanists. He believed in trying to make things better. He's actually a very peaceable person. He actually was the happiest when everyone left him alone just to read his books all day long. But he felt compelled with some of the things he'd learned, I really need to get involved. During the Reformation, he was alive during the Lutheran Reformation, and he was about the only person for a while trying very hard to find a common ground, trying very hard to mediate, understand, and listen to both sides. And so the extremists on both sides hated him. He was called a wimp and a coward and all kind of things, but he actually left a long-term legacy a lot more constructive than a lot of the other people from the era. One of the things that he did is he translated not translated, he recompiled the original Greek of the New Testament, because in the Catholic Church for many years, the only version you were allowed to leave was the ancient Latin version, the Latin Vulgate, which had been compiled by Jerome of Bethlehem in the late 4th century. It was 1,000 years out of date, but they had neglected the Greek manuscripts. And so Erasmus decided that if we're going to talk about the Bible, as a scholar, what I can do that no one else can do is I can go back to the Greek manuscripts and compile a Greek text of the Bible. He saw people like Wycliffe and Peter Waldo translating the Bible into what was then the modern languages, but he realized they have to translate it from the Latin. And that Latin version has a lot of errors in it. It shows the perspective of the Catholic Church in it. And so what everybody really needs is to get the original manuscripts. And until then, they had laid neglected for a long, long time in the West. And they were used in the Orthodox Church, but not in Western Europe. And so Erasmus published the Greek New Testament. He also published this massive series of little short essays and dialogues that he called the Colloquia. Very gentle satires on the church, because he didn't want to harm anybody. But he used humor and satire to bring out some of the flaws of what they were doing. He was constantly accused, and here's one of those things that's a timeless thing. You're a radical. You're trying to bring in these modern innovations to the church and change centuries of tradition. To which he could point out, actually, I'm just trying to get back to the way it was originally. It's old. What I'm trying to do is actually very old. As we have just pointed out, the concept of being less materialistic, that's not a new innovation that radicals come up with. That's actually was part of the original gospel right there that just makes us all extremely uncomfortable. That's all. Another guy you might have heard of is Thomas More. Thomas More is important in the history of philosophy also. He wrote this book called Utopia. Thomas More, in his time, was another Christian humanist. Now, he left a much more mixed legacy. Thomas More was fiercely loyal to the Catholic Church. As Lord Chancellor of England, he had a lot of Protestants burned at the stake for being heretics. So he's not the saint that a lot of people will make him out to be. You know, they had a popular movie when I was a kid, A Man for All Seasons. It was about what a wonderful guy Thomas More was. Well, he had some extremely good qualities, but he also enjoyed burning heretics. So that's a good thing to remember. They left that out of the movie, by the way. Thomas More is a person who was very loyal to the Catholic Church, but he also, again, used humor and satire to point out the flaws of the church. One of his favorite tricks, he wanted people to read the Bible, and he knew that the theologians of his age knew nothing about the Bible. So he would have these public debates with Catholic theologians, and he would say, you know, Matthew 29 says, he would quote a fictitious scripture. He'd say, you know, Matthew 29 says this, and here's what it means. Because he knew they wouldn't admit their ignorance. You know, no, they would say, no, here's what Saint so-and-so back in the 8th century said about that passage in Matthew 29. And then he'd say, there is no Matthew 29. And they would look foolish. Well, eventually, he became Lord Chancellor to Henry VIII of England, who doesn't have much of a sense of humor. And he got his head chopped off. But anyway, Thomas More kind of left this legacy. If you read his writings, even though he could kind of be brutal as a persecutor, he again kind of left some interesting things to think about during the time. At the same time, there was a guy in Italy, Florence, Italy, Savonarola, who was a moral reformer. This was a great movement in its time. Savonarola, directly in the heart of Catholic power, was calling the church and other people, again, to be less materialistic. He was proclaiming the New Testament, teaching that this accumulation of wealth is a problem. He also was very morally focused. Catholic popes of his era were people like Rodrigo Borgia, whose lives were filled with licentiousness and immorality. Savonarola is the one who invented what's called the bonfire of the vanities. He encouraged people, he would go from town to town and encourage people to bring immoral literature or religious statuary that he considered kind of quasi-idolatrous, and they'd have these big bonfires. Well, eventually his support proved rather fickle, and he was captured by angry church authorities and submitted to a lot of nasty tortures and burned. There's another group called the Mystics. The Mystics are a group that, not technically looking for reform or reformation, so much as expressing unfulfilled desires. In the late Middle Ages and even back into the High Middle Ages, there are a lot of really fascinating writers who are trying to break past the external. It's all about the relationship with God. If you ever read this great book, great devotional book, on the Imitation of Christ by Thomas A. Kempis from the 15th century, it's about getting past the external, getting past what you're doing, and just being with God, learning with God. If you might be more likely to have read Oswald Chambers' book, My Utmost for His Highest. It's somewhat of vaguely equivalent, modern equivalent, just trying to get past the outward and have a relationship with God. But Thomas A. Kempis was far from the only one. Lots of people all across Europe, they tended to be very loyal Catholics, tended to do all the external things they were supposed to, but tended to be very interested in seeking God for his own sake. And they left a lot of fascinating writings. Another one that's kind of a favorite of mine is Hildegard of Bingen. Hildegard was a little bit earlier. She was actually in the 12th century, and she left a lot of interesting writings. She also was a pioneer in the history of music. Those of you who listen to classical music, which I hope is a non-zero number of you, you may be aware that Hildegard of Bingen wrote some of the oldest surviving musical compositions. It's very important in the history of classical music because she took the older religious music, the Gregorian chants, which go back way into the early Middle Ages, and modernized them and turned it into what is very similar to what we call classical music compositions. And they're fascinating musically for what they say and also for the style of music that she composed. The point of the mystics was that they weren't really calling for we need a change or anything so much as just saying religion shouldn't be about all these rituals and everything. We ought to be knowing God. We ought to be seeking God. And again, they're bringing up an important point in a way very different from we would express it, but pointing to longings that God is meant to fulfill. The last piece of the puzzle that brought about the Reformation, and which is still very important to us today, is the printing press. You know, Johannes Gutenberg invented the printing press in the late 1400s. First book he printed was a Bible, and it made an enormous difference in the distribution of ideas. All of a sudden, you could produce Bibles and other literature quickly, on a mass scale, and much less expensively. Before Gutenberg, if you wanted to get a whole copy of the Bible, even if you got permission from the church officials to do so, it would cost you the average man's yearly wages. You know, to the equivalent today of tens of thousands of dollars to buy a whole Bible. That's why Wycliffe sent his people out with just a page at a time, because he couldn't afford to give them all a whole Bible. And the printing press made an enormous difference. Now, historically, printing already existed. Gutenberg didn't invent printing. What he invented was movable type printing. You're taking the individual letters and fitting them together to make words. The ancient Chinese invented printing a long time ago. But Gutenberg actually was the kind of guy, it actually involves several different inventions. If you're an engineer or something, you might want to read about it, because he had to invent a new metal alloy to make the little pieces of type out of. He had to invent a new kind of ink to work on this press of his, and he also redesigned the letters of the alphabet so that they would fit cleanly onto these tiny little pieces of type. So he's actually a very brilliant guy. And to guys like Wycliffe and other pioneers, they didn't have the benefit of that. Well, after Gutenberg and the Reformation era, everybody that wanted to print something could write it up, pay a little bit of money to get someone to print it up, and crank it off. And so not only did you have all kind of different versions of the Bible, what was called the vernacular translations, the modern language, contemporary language, which is still what our practice today. You also had people cranking out tracts and leaflets and everything, many of them very interesting and thought-provoking, and many of them very foolish and an enormous waste of time. So this printing press, like certain inventions today, makes it possible for anybody in the world to express their opinions more easily. Whether they're worth listening to or not is, of course, a different matter, another one of those timeless applications of human nature. But this becomes important, certainly in the Reformation, the effects that it had. It's also an inherent part of church history ever since. It's kind of one of the more comical parts of our own fellowship's history, the competition and battles between newsletters and magazines and so forth in the era of the Churches of Christ has always been a source of entertainment to a lot of people and a source of emotional disturbance to others, but it's something that we'll talk about a little bit later. The point is that the communication of ideas, for good or for ill, helps people to come to know God, because nobody can sit down all on their own in a vacuum and find their way to God all by themselves without a little bit of human help. It's not that God can't do it on your own, it's that God chooses to use us in each other's lives to keep us humble. It's a lot more fulfilling. It's a lot more efficient in a narrow technological sense, and it's much more in keeping with God's concept of us as the body of Christ. Trivia question, going back to animals, what creature has the largest eyes of any land-dwelling animal? Any of all the animals that live on land, which has the largest eyes? Do you think it's a tiger? Think it's a timber wolf? Remember Little Red Riding Hood, what big eyes you have, grandmother. Think it's a great horned owl? Yeah. Think it's an ostrich? Think it's a gorilla? Well, animals' eyes are fascinating, and I could talk about them for a long time, and someday I will. An animal's eyes give you a lot of clues as to what kind of life that it leads. Predatory animals like lions and tigers usually have eyes that are in the front of their heads that they create stereoscopic vision for improved depth perception, because the one crucial skill that they have is how to pounce on something at the right moment. They have very limited fields of vision, often have weak color vision, and often have weak detail vision, because all they need to do is judge where will that antelope be if I spring right now, and where will it be if I spring a second from now. And so tigers and other predatory animals don't have particularly large eyes or particularly sharp eyes. Cats have a reputation for sharp eyes because they can see better in darkness. Cats have an extra layer behind their retina that re-reflects light. Light that comes into a cat's eye is re-reflected, and that's why cats have the little glow in their eyes. It just maximizes the amount of light in darkness so that they can see better. But otherwise, their sight is all about depth perception. The animals that have the biggest eyes are not predatory animals. The animals that have the biggest eyes are animals that rely on flight to escape from things that are chasing them. The animals that have the biggest eyes are animals that need to see things at a long distance. Some prey animals don't need to have good eyesight because they're strong enough to defend themselves or they have weapons. A rhinoceros, for example, has some of the worst eyesight in the animal kingdom. They don't need to see anything. You try to hassle a rhinoceros, it doesn't need to see you. It just moves in your general direction and you'll regret hassling it. The ostrich has the biggest eyes of any land animal. Ostrich's eyes are about 5 times bigger than ours. Ostriches live in wide open plains where they have to see things coming from a long ways off. They have to tell if that spot way 2-3 miles away, if that little dark spot is an elephant or a lion. And they have to figure it out in time to make appropriate plans to avoid it if it's a lion, and to not worry about it if it's an elephant. The largest eyes in the animal kingdom belong to the giant squid. The giant squid's eyes are several times larger than any other animal's eyes. They're about as big as a basketball. The squids are predatory animals, but that's not why they have big eyes. A squid's vision is actually very poor in terms of detail. Squids actually have very poor eyesight, except for one thing. They have these enormous eyes so that they can see light many, many miles away, way down in the ocean. Because if you're a squid, you've got one thing to worry about in your life, and that's the sperm whale. Sperm whales are the only thing that cause squids any problems. But sperm whales are fast, and they're deadly. And so a squid can sense there's a tiny layer of bioluminescence that surrounds a sperm whale because of the microorganisms that attach to its skin. And the squid can see this tiny little bioluminescence many miles away and get out of there before the sperm whale gets there. Otherwise, the sperm whale will eat it. Animals vary widely in terms of their fields of vision. Predatory animals tend to look straight ahead. A horse has very large eyes. Horses have the largest eye of any mammal. Horses' eyes are larger than any other mammal. They're on the side of their head so that they can see a wide field of vision. There's a bird called the woodcock, which is a prey animal that has even better field of vision. Its eyes are exactly 180 degrees apart, and a woodcock does not have to move to see everything. Woodcock can see on top of its head, below it, on all sides, everything, all the way around, because woodcocks live lives of great excitement and danger. They need to get away from things a lot. Color vision varies significantly from animal to animal. Most animals have very good color vision. Mammals are actually the exception. Most mammals don't have particularly good color vision except for primates. Many animals that we would consider lower animals actually have even better color vision than humans do. A lot of birds and fish have good color vision. One of the best color visions belongs to the honeybee. Honeybees can see colors that we don't know even exist. Because honeybees can see the ultraviolet part of the spectrum, they can see colors that we don't even have names for. And there's probably some value in that, for a honeybee needs to distinguish different kinds of flowers and so forth. The simple point is this. Animals have widely varying different kinds of sight. It doesn't make any sense to say what animal has the best eyesight, because you can't say. If you want to say what animal is the best at spotting something a long ways away, then it's an ostrich, unless you're underwater, in which case it's a giant squid. If you want to say what animal has the best depth perception, then it's a tiger or a lion or a wolf. If you want to say what animal has the biggest field of vision, then it's the woodcock. Well, human beings have different kind of sights too. Now, animals have different kind of sight depending on what kind of life they lead. We have different kind of sight depending on how we've been conditioned. Your own personality, your upbringing, your cultural situation, they all condition us to see some things and see other things. I hope that you've got what you've gotten out of the last 2 weeks of class is all these different men and women who've said, we need to get back to the Bible. We need to let God's own word tell us what it means to be a Christian. We need to just get back to the gospel. But they've all seen different things in there. They've all noted, they've all picked up at a shot certain things that the others missed. And then they all had big blind spots, just as we have big blind spots, just as we have certain things that we see very clearly that others don't or didn't. And the whole point is, again, a call. When we talk about this idea of restoring the New Testament church, the one essential ingredient that we need to have above all is humility, to live by grace, to accept it by grace, not to judge what others are doing, to appreciate what they did for what it was, to learn in humility, and to help each other to find out what it really means to seek God and know God, because that's one of the great mysteries of life that we mortals will never completely solve. Thank you for your patience. Went over again, and I'm sorry about that, but we will see you again next week.